Welcome to the Product Design Podcast. I'm your host, Seth Coolin, founder of UX Cabin, where we create world-class web and mobile apps. I'm excited to bring you a behind-the-scenes look into the lives of some of the most interesting and talented people in product design. We'll get strategic advice on how they got to where they are today and things they wish they would have known earlier in their career. Thanks for tuning in to the Product Design Podcast. Today, we have Jake Taylor with us. He is a principal product designer just outside of Denver, Colorado. Jake has a ton of awesome experience that I'm excited to dive into. He's held pretty much every single role you can imagine in the UI, UX product design space and worked at everything from enterprise corporations to startups. Jake, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Jake, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I have two young boys running around the house, ages 10 and 4. So those keep me fairly busy outside of work. Obviously during work, running with multiple product teams at any given time, trying to do as much forward thinking as possible and just continue on execution and innovation.
Awesome. So Jake, how did you get started in UI, UX, product design?
Yeah, I was really fortunate starting school in 2002 with an interactive web and media degree and then graduating in 2006. I could have swore up and down that I was going to be a Flash ActionScript coder. Flash was the go-to media back in the day, and I loved designing for motion and interactivity. And so during a portfolio review, I had a group of folks come by and were interested in my work, and we talked a bunch, and that actually led to one of my first interviews right out of school. It ends up, I get the job. It's for a company called CQG, still around in Denver. Part of the role is to upgrade a legacy trading application to newer styles, newer design patterns, newer interactions. And so sort of just stumbled right from a mixed media degree of web design and web engineering or development to product design back in its early stages. The group that hired me actually just came from Frog Design out of Austin. So three senior designers led the group that I was hired into. And so that's actually how I started really cutting my teeth or got my beginning in UX.
Wow, that's awesome. When you went into college, did you know that you wanted to be in digital media, or how did you know that you wanted to do this versus something more generic like science or accounting or the big broad things that kids go to school for today?
Yeah, I knew I wanted to be on the digital side. The web was obviously new back in 2002 and still had a lot of growing to do. And obviously we're evolving every day, but I knew something digital. And then once I got into it more and more on the creative side, less engineering, less development, less coding, and more true design. That's evolved over time, obviously, but I knew sort of early on that digital was the realm I wanted to be in.
So when you started off coding and developing like these Flash action script things, and you kind of thought that was your career trajectory, were you like really disappointed when you started to see the writing on the wall for like, this is probably not going to be the way of the future? Or were you excited by the prospect of learning something new?
Oh, I was bummed. Yeah. They start to sunset the application that you're basing a lot of your work off of. And they did that not immediately, but pretty close when I got into the field. And so I tried to hold on to it. There's times in my career that should I go back to more true web design, trying to navigate where do you think all of this work and all of this need is going to go? And every time I ended up sticking with more of the product design route because it was something I was good at and something that I'd already start to build a foundation on.
That's awesome. Why don't you give us a little overview of your career history, just so we can understand the breadth and depth of everything that you've done over your career?
Sure. So I've spent graduating in 2006. My first role was in 2007, like I said, at the CQG, the trading company. I spent 3 years there, decided to go freelance for a year, and then got married and shortly after was expecting my first son. So it was time for a steady paycheck and steady direction rather than freelance. Was able to get back into a steady job and a steady work. And from there, I've worked at ePayment Solutions. I've worked at enterprise booking applications at Travelport. I was a UX architect at Merkle, which is one of the top 10 CRM marketing agencies. Done consulting with Aetna, done consulting with Deloitte Digital, places like that. And then more recently, working at Pitney Bowes, overseeing the international suite of applications for 3 years. And then closer to recent, DoD work for Rocket Communications. So building enterprise dashboards for space monitoring and satellites. So super interesting. One of the more interesting roles I've had. You don't get a chance to design for space very often, especially with all the other work I've done. So I jumped at the opportunity and it was a great time. It's a lot of learning and a lot of ins and outs, but a lot of good design.
That is really cool. What have been some of the high points and low points of your career as you look back?
I think one of the high points at Pitney Bowes, we were very close to our VP of product management, and he completely supported our mission and the direction we were headed with a lot of user validation, a lot of research early on in products and iterating quickly on those. And so with those efforts, I was able to do a bunch of traveling internationally on behalf of Pitney. I was able to go to London and kick off projects with internal teams. I was able to travel around Amsterdam and do client interviews alongside the product management folks. And then I got to spend a week and a half sort of tailing our VP of product and piggybacking on his meetings that he already had, setting up other side user testing sessions and user interviews, and just working our way through Sydney and to Melbourne.
Wow, that seems like an incredible opportunity. Were there any specific low points during your career?
Yeah, I've definitely been in some of those larger enterprise settings where it is a cubicle field as far as you can see. And they're gray, the walls are gray, really not the most creative environment to be in. And it almost turns into a lot of grind. On top of that, I felt like my manager was very disconnected from day to day, didn't care as much, I guess. It turns a little soul sucking at the end. On top of that, not seeing work go into the product that you spend a lot of time on and execute on with various teams. I think that was probably one of my least favorite parts of my career that you got to experience and go through just to know what environment you don't want to spend time in moving forward.
Yes, I remember consulting for this one larger company, and they were truly a cubicle farm. And I was so thankful that I was only consulting for them. There was like an endpoint, because it was just so completely soul sucking. And it's like, I don't care how much anyone would pay me to sit here for 8 hours a day. I just could not do it long term.
Nope, not at all. Yeah. And it doesn't help the creativity thrive. It does turn into your piece of that cog that continues to move forward. And yeah, same as you. I've been in the consulting opportunities to where you're like, thankfully, this is only lasting 6 months and not anymore, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. But I guess, like you were saying, you kind of have to figure out your preferences when you get into working, because one of the benefits of one of those places is that if you really want something just kind of slow and steady, that's kind of a good environment, because you're probably not working at breakneck speed. We talk about it like it's like the worst thing ever, but for the right personality type, that could be a really comforting environment and someone could thrive there. Honestly.
Oh, absolutely. And it depends on the group within those settings. You could be in a good position, like I was in an enterprise setting at Pitney, where travel was welcomed and encouraged and user outreach, and in a position to help drive product design. Other situations might not be as welcoming. And you get that consistency, you get the steady work, but the change of pace and the change of work, I think, is what drew me away from that.
Absolutely. So you worked in large companies and small companies. How would you explain the difference in either work environment, work expectations, or even just your personal flavor of what you enjoy more?
I've been on both sides of the coin, from consultancy and enterprise and the variation of a startup. They both have their pros and cons. Consultancy is great to come on as a SME within your discipline and be able to sort of run the show according to your company's point of view and your value props, which is great. The downside of that, I feel like, is you lose a lot of control over collaboration. there's a lot of potential hurdles with. You can't just sort of casually ping your client and say, hey, can I ask you this? Can I ask you that? They're generally not on Slack with you, but you can't set up a meeting and be on a meeting in 5 minutes like you could with an internal product team. You lose a lot of control over roadmap and potentially resources. They're going to have a budget. You have no influence over that budget. They have a set amount of time that you can work with it, and you're going to hit those marks and milestones. I was drawn back into an internal product design role because I wanted that open collaboration. I was looking for more influence over what goes into the product, how the work is accomplished, and things of that nature. And that's really where I thrive is I have a question. I want to reach out to you. I want to jump on the phone real quick, jump on a call, and then just keep moving. You lose a lot of that in the consultancy environment.
Working in an internal product team, do you ever get worn down by working on the same thing day in and day out?
On the larger products, for sure. You do get a lot of time for planning. You do get a lot of time for execution, which is great. And depending on how you want to spend the extra time, I was doing lunch and learns with the larger company, and I was working on chatbots at a given time. I was really heavy into learning more with the extra time. But yeah, you definitely have a little bit more to do, and then there's less likely more foundational work to do. And so design process stuff, design system stuff, stuff of that nature. And so again, sort of attracting me back to the startup spaces, you get a chance to influence some of those early design process decisions, how things work, how teams work together, and be part of these different pieces that you might lose some influence on in the larger product groups.
Totally makes sense. So you've had a lot of experience and time to consider and look back. If you were to give yourself advice, something that you wish you had known when you were starting off in your career, what would you have told yourself?
Designs don't have to be perfect to get the point across. I think early on in my career, very ambitious, wanting to show the best options every time. And you still want to do that. For me, it's in a different fidelity. So I would spend so much time on first round of concepts that I was very attached to them. And so by the time we got to feedback rounds, I was almost taking feedback personally because I had already invested a bunch of time in this and I had done all the thinking. I thought this was right. Like, there shouldn't be any feedback. And there's going to be feedback, whether it's from engineering, whether from product owners. And so, yeah, I mean, I would just understand that nobody bats 1,000. Nothing is perfect out the gate. And the big thing for me is get something that you think will be successful in parts or pieces in front of people for review. And then just start iterating as quickly as you can. I think that's where I like to live, is the sort of the concept ideation area of our discipline.
That's really cool. I think looking back at my career, when I'm starting off in design, I think I almost tried to overcompensate on the high fidelity side of things because I wanted the solution to be good. But rather than focusing most of my time on the solution, I was focusing on the appearance of the solution. So I would really try to sell something. And oftentimes I could sell it because it looked so beautiful and so good. But the beauty of something and the usefulness of something aren't always connected, right? So I think that was a really hard learning point, in that people are not going to just accept a design based on if it looks good or not. There's a lot more that goes into it.
Yeah. And just because we can sell it and sell it well doesn't mean that it was always right. Another thing I learned is, are you going to be able to rely on best practices and principles when you do get feedback? And what have you been considering? If you haven't had time for user validation and things of that nature, have you at least been doing the competencies of best design practices and be able to fall back on data if you do have existing data? Because in those wireframe stages, without the high fidelity polish, that's all you'll have to go on. A lot of times is, this is the pattern. This is what people are used to. This is the reason why I decided to go this direction.
Yeah. And I think this also might be an interesting inflection point between agency work, consulting work, and internal in-house product design work. Because if you're doing something as an agency and you're presenting it to someone, you want them to feel like they're getting the best absolute product. And a lot of times that comes with that is it looking visually really nice. Versus if you're an internal product team, you probably have a little bit more forgiveness as to like, this is just a random idea and I just wrote it on this piece of paper. People can kind of see the value in the idea behind it rather than it looking very polished.
Yeah, that's a great point. There is an expectation in the consultancy agency realm that you know best, right? And you're only presenting the best options, and you should be. And that's what you're getting paid to do. Hopefully we're doing our due diligence on our side to do the proper research and make sure we are presenting those options. And I think to your point, the internal team gives you a lot more flexibility with a little bit of failure involved, right? Like you can throw out a random idea and if it sticks, it sticks. And if it doesn't, we just keep working. You do that in front of a client, it's a little different response.
Totally. Thinking about the advice you would have given yourself back in 2006-ish, if someone's watching this today or listening to this, and they want to be involved in product design to some degree, they maybe want to get into an agency or an in-house team, what advice would you give them to get into the field starting from ground zero?
I would say try and identify your strengths. I think we all have strengths that we bring to the table, and that could be from previous work outside of design. It doesn't have to be related to design. If you're in customer service, if you are an auto mechanic, there are strengths that you can bring to the design field that make you who you are and make you compelling to a company. So for me, I didn't consider myself the best designer out of my class or out of my group that I graduated with, but I was a really good people person. And so throughout my career, I've realized I'm good at meeting people. I'm good at forming these relationships and I'm pretty easy to get along with for the most part. And so I fell back on what I considered a strength of mine. And that's worked so far. I would think about that and think about how you like to work. Are you a systematic thinker? Are design systems calling your name? Are you super creative and you need those blue skies and green fields? And what does that look like for you? So start to consider those different things.
That's really good. I was just tweeting about what I look for in a designer when I'm bringing someone on. And when I got to the end of the list, I realized that 3 out of the 4 things that I especially look for are actually soft skills versus core design skills. So the fact of the matter is design skills can be taught and they can be learned. But if you're a jerk or if you're hard to work with, there's no real telling when that's going to change or improve.
Yeah, there's a lot less room for you in organizations if you come across that way. I think people are less likely to help you, but you're less likely to get good feedback and good responses, just depending on how you present yourself. It's interesting that way. Same way with tools. So I'm pretty tool agnostic for the most part. I have a lot of the design fundamentals. If I have to learn a new tool, if I have to ramp up, that's great. My design skills are still there regardless. Design skills you carry with you, and same with those soft skills.
Absolutely. One thing that you touched on in your last comment was being able to accept feedback well. And being in the space for a while, do you have any tips or tricks for either how to give feedback, how to receive feedback, how to facilitate it among a team or even among a client?
Yeah, absolutely. I learned a good trick early on, and that was trying to identify what the feedback might be ahead of time in your head and walking through those gotchas and what that response might be. So again, thinking about why you made the design decisions you did, but then what is the opposite side of that? So did you think about this? Did you think about that? We don't currently do it that way. Why would you suggest this? And those kind of gotchas that you might not sort of think of every time, but just to go through them before you go into a big meeting and understand this is a different font color than they're used to. I need to be able to explain that. This is a different image style than what they've seen before. I need to be able to explain why I did that. Everything from those big gotchas to the small ones, you never know what a client is going to be attracted to and what they're going to pick up on.
Really cool. Yeah, that's good. I'm sure you've been in a spot either yourself or with younger designers who maybe feel more attached to a design because they were the ones that created it, or you feel very passionate about something. How do you remove the personal feelings of I created this away from the critical feedback of moving something forward?
It bothered me so much early on in my career. It really did. And just learning to let go of those things. I think what it comes down to is unless you're in a role where we're curing cancer or things of that nature, things are really important, but are they important enough to really let drag on and let get at you? Are you able to do excellent work, know you did excellent work, and then leave it behind? And that's one of the harder things to do, know that something might not make it to release. And now that's something to where as you get more used to it, that's something you're accustomed to. You're going to start with something beautiful, full range of all the feature and functionality you want. And then the team's going to come back and say, we need to start cutting features so that we can get this out the door. And so how would you do that? What pieces can you lose? What's integral to the form and function of the design to keep? It gets easier over time, but it was super hard in the beginning. It hurts for a while.
Yeah, I think part of that is trusting your team that everyone's trying to get to the best possible outcome. Because I know in my earlier career, I felt like things were really political and design pieces were chosen based on who did them, not what was best. This is just purely in my mind, right? So maybe it's true, maybe it's not true, but I didn't trust that the designs that were chosen were always for the right reasons. It was like, this person's usually right. So whatever they say is going to be chosen over mine. But I was more junior at the time. And I felt like in that scenario, I kind of had to like fight more for my design. But if everyone's like, all we care about is the best possible product outcome, it's a lot easier to remove the personal feelings of I did this or so-and-so did this. And you can kind of more so trust the process.
Completely agree. I think a lot of that, if you look back, it goes back to them being able to sell their designs potentially better than we were at that time, being more junior. And so it does go back to like how you're presenting it and how you're speaking to it. And did they follow the best practices? And that's why they decided to go that way. And I think the reason what makes our design stronger, and that's where you get more open to the feedback, is everyone looks at it in a different lens. And so I think the more different perspectives you can get on these things, the better the design's going to be, because these are all real life sets of eyes that are seeing things that are most likely valid or need to be tested.
Right. Now, there's so many different considerations when presenting work. Maybe you're presenting work to engineering, and really all they're thinking about is what is going to be the most expedient path forward. Or maybe you're showing it to a gung-ho entrepreneur, and what he or she wants is just the most mind-bending, forward-thinking design possible. Or maybe you're showing it to a product person, and all they want to do is just like validate the problem. Does this help the user? Is this the right solution? And I think you kind of have to be prepared for what am I presenting and why?
Yeah, you have to know your audience, and you nailed it. I think engineering is going to look at, are we using existing patterns? Where are we deviating? Why are we deviating? And what's the cost associated to that? You have to be prepared to back those up and in your mind, potentially have those places where you want to stand your ground and say, this is an interaction that is new. This is what I feel is the best. We should scope it. And that's where a lot of this, and sort of another soft skill that we spoke about, is being flexible with your collaborators. There's always a give and take. Us as designers or engineers or product owners, we're not going to get everything that we want every time. And so be prepared to find a middle ground that you're happy with, that you think the product will still be successful.
Yeah, that's a really interesting dynamic, because I have worked in companies, in four companies, that lean one way or the other very strongly as either being engineering led, where basically engineering gets to make the call 100% of the time as to what gets included, or companies that are more design led, where it's like, if design thinks this is best, figure it out. Have you noticed anything in your experience as to like what is a good balance between that interaction, or if there's typically a better method of either design led or engineering led?
I don't know if I've ran into a better method. It definitely exists. I would say in most companies, we are going to be outnumbered by engineering. We're sort of an afterthought a lot of times, whether it's 8-1, 10-1, 50-1, you're the sole designer, the army of one. But I think that's also where involving your developers early and often to get that early sign off or consensus to be able to help drive your designs forward. And then sort of goes back to whether it's sort of spotting those gotchas and getting some validation, or knowing your audience and speaking to them differently. But the more that you can get that early sign off from potentially the people who are making the calls or the people that are surrounding them, if you can get into that larger review and you already have five people that are giving you a thumbs up, it makes it a lot easier to drive some of those interactions forward.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because it's almost not fair to show something to someone for the first time ever and then expect them to be able to give feedback on that. Like, what do you think of this brand new thing that you're going to have to build? Usually it's going to be like, defenses are up. I am not comfortable with this. I don't want to agree to this until I really think through it, which might give a really nice hat tip to asynchronous reviews where someone has time to look at it, consider it, think through it fully before they're forced to give feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. There's always going to be sticker shock associated to new designs. And so being very wary of ever just tossing something over the wall blindly without context. I think being able to contextualize your design thinking and the reasoning will help make that conversation go smoother. If you toss it over the wall and they get hit with sticker shock, whether you're in good standing with them or not, the sticker shock will probably win. And then there will be more design churn and more design conversations just to sort of roll it back to a good place.
Yeah. And kind of to your point of getting them on board earlier than the formal design review is a really interesting concept. Because if you're working with someone or you know they're going to have to work on it and you're like, hey, listen, I know this one component is crazy, but I think it's really good for these reasons. And you can kind of let them think about it and consider it before you're in a room with their engineering lead and they have to make a call on something one way or the other.
Well, and it's huge that some of the best pieces I feel like I've been able to build have been when I've had the best working relationships with the people who are going to be doing the development. And like you said, if I can explain my reasoning to those one or two folks that are going to be responsible, and if they're behind it and they start doing their research and they're like, well, it's only going to take X more effort to be able to make this work smoothly, we'll get into that larger meeting. There's still going to be sticker shock. There will still be leadership saying, well, what is this? And then you have something to fall back on. And then again, sort of have those secondary options that you've already thought about. So as you have to cut down a product design that you've worked on, what are the alternatives that potentially could make it easier or safer to develop?
Yeah. Yeah, that's really good. Kind of having the full spectrum of product design titles and jobs, wanted to get your take on mentorship, whether you have seen mentorship and a part of it or participated in it as a mentor, what your experience in design mentorship has been over the years.
Yeah, so I've had a lot of good luck with ADP List, obviously one of the bigger organizations, and they just got a bunch of funding. They're very successful and offer a great platform. I've been fortunate enough to work with a couple other really meaningful groups of folks. And for me, it's one of those rewarding pieces that works for both the mentor and the mentee. I feel like it's made me a stronger designer in terms of being able to relate to people outside of your design group, people that you're used to talking design with and hashing through things, being able to relate to someone potentially on a different level and explain things differently and give them the insights similar to how we're doing now to help them make bigger steps in their career. And it was something that wasn't popular when I was coming up the ranks, and it would have been welcomed. I think you find a couple of those people who have really helped you in your career. But to now have the resources of, you have directors from Dropbox, you have senior designers from Amazon that you can reach out to. These are all people who have been successful. And now if they're open to sharing their knowledge, it's huge.
Now, what is this organization or group called?
So ADP List is a mentor platform that you can search on your focused discipline, on what career titles or other things that your mentor you're looking for is in. It's a great platform. They just received our first round of funding, and it's exciting to see them grow over the last year and a half or so.
That's really cool. I haven't heard of them. I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah, we gave them a plug.
So knowing that mentorship really helps create a better team environment, obviously, there has to be hard conversations sometimes between mentees and mentors. Do you have any insight into how to have those hard conversations with people when you need to?
I've ran into both sides of management styles in my career, some more encouraging than others. For me, some of the harder conversations just in the last few years have been able to really have is, what are your goals and aspirations for your career moving forward? And how can this company or this work get you there? For me, work should be mutually beneficial, right? So it should help us pay our bills. We should be providing value to the company at the same time, but then it needs to work a little bit farther than that and give us the growth opportunities that we want or desire. And so I've ran into having a hard conversation with a manager and asking, my goal is to become a lead within this company. And the manager, without thinking about it, said, that role is probably not going to exist here. And it was hard because, one, now that I know how management could have responded, telling me that that role isn't going to exist did nothing but demotivate me from trying to continue my career there. The opposite of that is you get a very welcoming response when I was trying to make principal at Pitney Bowes. And my manager was like, that's awesome. Let's make a plan. I'll work with you and let's make these steps to get you where you want to be and I'll back you up. I think that's the more welcoming approach, obviously. That's the approach that we should be taking with a lot of these positions. But it is hard to respectfully have those conversations and some of those hard ones. But if you don't put yourself out there, no one's going to do it for you. You might have champions behind you, but they're not going to say, we should promote Seth. You need to put that out there to the world and let it be known.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic piece of advice because a lot of times we want to be either recognized or promoted because internally we see that we're doing a good job and we think others should recognize it. Even if other people notice it and recognize it, management might not know you want to take the next step. Some people are content, right? So I think to your point, you have to ask for what you want in order to have a chance at getting it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have to be comfortable with tooting your own horn. And that doesn't mean to be obnoxious about it, to be cocky or disrespectful to others. It is, to your point, recognition and achievements and moving forward in your career, if that's what you want to do. A couple pieces that I've learned that have helped me, one being establishing your own 360 feedback loops. So as you get started in a new company, or you may already be existing in a company, setting up reoccurring meetings with those peers in other disciplines that you can not only have an open line of communication for, but you can continue to grow and learn from those people within. And they don't have to be part of design. They can be engineering leaders. They can be product leaders. They can be customer support leaders. Whoever you feel you can learn from and you get along with and you want to be closer to, feel free to schedule those meetings. And as you continue to make progress on certain products or certain initiatives, save those kudos that you're doing well. Set up a kudos folder on your desktop. As you get a response email saying, this is awesome design, we're getting great adoption, whatever those numbers may be, save those emails. And in your annual reviews, that just makes it that much easier to continue to build your case to get to where you want to go.
Nice. I'm interested about these 360 feedback loops that you mentioned. Now, are these a little bit more in the realm of networking within your own company and just exposing yourself to more people and becoming more well-liked? Or is it kind of like soliciting feedback from different groups of people as to how you could be better at your particular skill set?
I think it's a lot of both. I think the more known and known as well-respected resource within the company is not a bad position to be in. The other hand, you can ask for feedback, get feedback, and treat it as part of your growing and getting better process. So let me know when you get feedback from your teams that they think I've missed something, that I'm not hitting their expectations. And it's nothing but being proactive about how you present yourself and how you can grow within your career.
Yeah, that's awesome. So another thing that I wanted to chat about is obviously with the last year and some change of the pandemic and a lot of people working remote. How have things been for you working remotely and how did that situation go for you, your family, your mental health, burnout, all of that?
Yeah, it's been huge. I've been remote, dedicated remote for the last 5 or so years, starting with Pitney Bowes, because I was working so many international hours. And so those 5 a.m. calls, you pretty much have to take from your house. But it's added a lot of humanity, I feel like, to the working from home and a lot of understanding for everyone's different situations, right? So these curveballs that the pandemic and these working from home situations have thrown us, I think it's affected everyone and it affects everyone differently. And so just the level of understanding and the level of flexibility that these companies are now giving us, and then us as employees and working side by side with each other, my boys will be on the couch over here doing their thing if they need to, and others will have their kids running around in the background. And I think it's something that has built a level of understanding and a sense of humanity that wasn't there before. I think people are still running into a lot of the, are they working from home? Are they getting the work done? But I think there's a lot less of that. That was the old stigma. And now it's like, well, I have a view into this person's life and we don't have control over everything. This is just life and we need to take it as it comes.
Yeah, I look back to that one viral YouTube video where that little girl breaks in on her dad's CNN interview or something like that. And everyone was like, this is so funny and crazy. And it's like, for 2020, this was the norm. That's kind of a cool way you put it, humanizing this corporate culture of remote work where life and work are completely separate and bringing a little bit more humanity of like, no, Joe from so-and-so actually has a kid or animals or things that he has to take care of. And you get a little glimpse into people's lives.
And I think you get better at planning and setting clear expectations with your teams to be able to have those flexibilities. It makes you proactive in what you do. And for me, it's helped really draw a line of where my work-life balance is. I tend to get sucked into a role, get sucked into the work, and could overwork myself all the time. I've recently figured out that if those extra 2 hours aren't really going to make a difference. Is this a one-off extra 2 hours of the day, or is this going to be every day this week? And if it's going to be every day this week, is it really worth it? Should I just tailor it back a little bit? Still get your work done, still prioritize accordingly and set expectations with your team. But it's something that I think, again, side effect of the work from home is the work is still there, right? When you go to walk away.
Yeah, I think a part of that, we kind of have to lean in and embrace. So in the office, right, you have these clear distinctions of I'm at work or I'm not at work. And it's very binary, on or off. And you can't really fully do that at home if you have other family members or especially children in your home. So I think for me personally, what I like to do is grab little pockets of time with my family, with my kids throughout the day and not make it such a hard starting and stopping point. It's like maybe I want to go to the park with my kids for an hour. And then maybe I want to work from 9 to 10 at night. So I try not to be so rigid in my mind, like these are working hours and these are family hours, but more so just feeling the flow of the day. It's hard to be creative for 8 hours a day, or it's hard to use your mind for that. So maybe chunk it up, maybe work a little bit after dinner, maybe work early in the day. And that's something that's helped me and my family.
Yeah, absolutely. That's all very true. I think the other piece of it is understanding when you do your best work and when to potentially not force it.
Yeah.
I have a really hard time trying to work when your mind's not there or you really have to get something done, but it's just not working out. Are you going to bang your head against the wall or are you going to recognize that this is the time I need to take a break and go on the walk that you said or clear my mind? Because the work's going to be there when you get back. That really doesn't matter. Sometimes if you find the most efficient time, and you're working the best, you could get 8 hours of work done in a 4 hour chunk, just really at your prime rather than having to be at your desk like you would in a typical situation and trying to grind out 8 hours where let's figure out the best times and optimize.
Yeah, definitely. Now, over your career, have you ever experienced burnout or a situation where you're like, wow, I've worked 60 hours for 6 months straight and I'm just wrecked, or anything like that where you noticed it was out of balance?
Yeah, it got that way with a lot of those early calls at Pitney Bowes, just the international time zones for us being in central time in Denver didn't make the most sense. I was super happy with the product, super happy with the position. It just 3 years of 5 a.m. calls, it'll put a tax on you. And between there, I had my second child, and that's where the work-life balance just became that more important. There's times where, again, speaking up earlier or more often probably could have fixed some of these things. But at the same time, I think us as employees and people can only go so far until you reach that point to where it's time for a change. Let's make a conscious effort to do something else.
Yeah, that can be tough. And I think kind of what you said earlier in one of your other points was the work's always going to be there. And I know someone running a business, there's always more work to do. If I wanted to, I could work 24 hours a day straight and I would always find more things to do. And it's hard to shut it down. It's hard to prioritize what's most meaningful to work on when there's a lot of good things, there's a lot of priorities, there's a lot of things that are kind of in your face, and knowing what to spend your time on, what to ignore, what to push, and what to backlog.
Yeah. And it's something that I think is a skill in itself, is being able to prioritize accordingly. Are you prioritizing by urgency? Are you prioritizing by level of effort? What are the expectations that you set to stakeholders previously? Those types of things. And I think as we get more comfortable in our careers and the people we work with, those things become a lot easier. And especially when you get used to asking, this is when this is due. Is there any leeway there? Should I plan on this is the drop dead date? Things like that. And then it makes it a little easier to prioritize based on those things.
Yeah, I think even working with clients, that's an interesting thing, because a lot of times there's tons of work that can go around and you sometimes need to make someone else make the call of what's more important so that you don't get overloaded on your plate. And that can be a hard conversation too. It's like, I want it all, right? It's all important. What do you mean deprioritize something?
Yep. Yeah. And one of the methods there that I've run into, especially when you get into a client or a stakeholder that keeps asking for more things and they aren't necessarily prioritized, the response back is, what would you like me to take off my plate? All of these things are a certain priority. Tell me what this one is. And if you want to squeeze in, what one do you want me to pull out? And start to really think about what work can you do reasonably without reaching that burnout point. And you'll get more and more comfortable with estimating that work and what you can achieve in certain times. But the thing I've learned, well, if it's so important, what can I knock down on the other list that I have to get it done? And that sort of puts it back on them, right? They have to now think about it. Well, maybe it's not that important. Maybe it is more important than the other things you have. And so it's a good clarifier for sure.
That's awesome. Yeah. So rounding out this conversation, wanted to get your take on, as you consider junior people to potentially bring on your team, what are some of the things that you look for in an individual product designer, researcher that you want someone to have to be able to bring onto your team or help mature and grow your team?
Yeah, we touched on it earlier. I think the big thing is, do you see yourself working with this person day in and day out, especially for early career folks? Are they someone who you think is teachable, who is hungry to learn and hungry to gain more knowledge? I think what I've learned is you can't teach drive, whether an individual is driven or not, and they see themselves growing in the field. And that's something we don't have control over. But for me, it's something that I have a harder time putting my effort forward if you're not following up with the drive and understanding of this. But all of those things, I think the skills come, the product knowledge comes with the role, the learning of the tools comes with the role. It's really, can I work with this person? Are they hungry to learn? How far can we take this relationship? Because in the end of the day, that's what it ends up being. You're not only coworkers, you could be potentially friends depending on how things play out.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's really cool about remote work, that it kind of opened up the space to have a much larger pool of awesome people to work with, right? You're not just limited to your singular location and people within 30 miles of you, right? You get a whole smattering of opportunity of people across the country or even across the world. And you can really pull in amazing, awesome people that maybe would be hard to find in a 30-mile radius around you.
And they all come from different backgrounds. They all have different point of views. I've worked with great people from India, with great people from Europe and around the world. And you're just thankful that you get the opportunity to work with these folks. And like you said, they're bringing different things to the table, and they're potentially people that wouldn't have been in range of your company had it not been for remote work.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Jake, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on and share your knowledge, share your wisdom and insight. Thank you so much for this time. We hope to talk again sometime in the future.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today on the Product Design Podcast. If you enjoyed our conversation, be sure and go follow our guest. Let them know they did a great job and you learned a lot. More to come in the following weeks as we bring on new guests. Please hit that subscribe button so that you will get these podcasts and learn a ton about the product design community. Excited to see you next time. Thanks.